Today on the TV Time Machine, we welcome Professor Robert J. Thompson. Professor Thompson is a trustee professor of television and popular culture at Syracuse University and is the founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture. Over the next segment, Professor Thompson will talk about television's past, present, and future, the impact of changing technology, and whether or not this current generation of student even knows who Archie Bunker is. Again, for those of you intrepid enough to find a cure for your mortar boredom, feel free to matriculate this program as we cram in the past in order to guarantee a textbook present. Professor, thank you for coming on board the TV Time Machine.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Professor, tell us about Syracuse University, the Bleier Center, and Newhouse School, and the unique curriculum that is the focus of your classes.
Yeah, well, the Syracuse University has been teaching television and radio back actually before television. We had a radio master's degree back in the 1940s, so it goes back a long way. And I got there in 1990 and started teaching TV history and criticism, and we opened this center in 1997. So back then, you know, there weren't as many places that were doing this, but now the study of television in the college classroom, in when I first started doing this in the early 1980s, it was considered a very strange thing to be giving college credit for watching television. Now it's not so strange. We kind of won that battle.
So over the years, what has changed most about your classes and the students who attend your classes?
Well, what's really changed is when I first started, and I started teaching this at Northwestern way back in the early 1980s, and it was a professor's dream come true, because you would go into the class and you could assume that every single person there had a pretty good working knowledge of the history of television. And not just the stuff that they grew up with watching when it was new, but they had a pretty good knowledge of the stuff that was on before they were born. Because back then, early 80s, people were just starting to get cable, and a lot of people had grown up with a few channels in their market, so they'd see the new shows that played on primetime. But after school, they would see the Brady Bunch reruns and I Dream of Jeannie reruns. And so it was unlike if you're teaching a Shakespeare class, you cannot assume that the kids have read anything but maybe Romeo and Juliet or and maybe one or two others. Back then, you could assume that people had seen I Love Lucy and All in the Family and the Mary Tyler Moore Show and all the stuff then that went into their memories. The strange thing was that as cable kicked in, much more opportunity to see those old shows. But since they had so much choice, many fewer people watched them because they had other opportunities. They didn't want to watch old TV shows that their parents and grandparents used to watch. And then when the internet kicked in, we now have an opportunity to see way more of the history of television than we ever had before in all of history. But since there's so many other choices, very few people are searching that stuff out, even though it's there. So now, unlike when I started, I can't make the assumptions that everybody knows this stuff. I have a class this semester of about 120 students. And out of curiosity, I asked when Mary Tyler Moore died, how many had never seen a complete episode of the Mary Tyler Moore Show? And every single one of those students, without exception, 100%, raised their hand. Not a single one of them had seen a complete episode of that. And that's still, even though I know that's a new reality, that was very hard for me to come to grips with. So now, if I talk about old stuff, I've got to send them on their own to see it, or put it on reserve in the library, like we used to do, you know, with Chaucer.
Well, what percentage of students even knew who Mary Tyler Moore was?
Well, I think still that name is something that they've heard of, just like we've heard of a lot of the, you know, old stars from long before we were born. But certainly not everyone would have known that. Matter of fact, on the day that she died, this is not my students, but I was at the urologist getting my kidney stones examined, which shows what generation I'm from. And there was a woman who was doing the ultrasound, and I said, "Oh, did you hear? Mary Tyler Moore just died. They just announced it." And here was a person who was old enough to have gone to medical training and was running the high technology of an ultrasound machine, and she had no idea who Mary Tyler Moore was.
So was there a catalyst year where you really noticed that everything changed in terms of your students' past knowledge of TV history?
Well, it was it was kind of a gradual transition in that, no, I don't think there was one year we point to. And it was a weird transition because on one level, when cable came out, it both gave and took away in the sense that by giving people more choice, they were less likely to watch things because they had to watch them. I watched old episodes of I Love Lucy because that's what was on. I didn't have that many choices. Cable gave people more choices, so they were less likely to look, especially at old black and white reruns. However, cable also gave us Nick at Night, which then became its own channel with TV Land. So in some ways, there was a period where they actually had more opportunities to see those things if, in fact, they decided to do that. And there were a lot of kids that were watching Nickelodeon during the day that would then, by default, see some of that old stuff during the night. And that was when Nick at Night was doing exclusively old programming. But I think it's when internet video really became faster, not so much buffering problems. So as we got to the turn of the century, and as more and more internet viewing became available, then there were so many other choices, and people thought, you know, why watch this old thing when I can watch something that I really want to see? And that was a big difference, because then you really have people who their viewing becomes so distinct by generation. And then that's always been true. We remember the shows we watched when we were growing up. But we also were, in many ways, kind of forced to watch the things that were from before we were growing up. I watched a lot of Three Stooges, which would have been the culture of my parents and grandparents. I watched old movies from their era because, once again, that was what was on, and it was the best choice of various stations. Nobody now has to watch that kind of thing. They've got so many other opportunities, and not only with television, even the classic movies that you thought everybody by 25 would have been exposed to, even though they may have been made way before they were born. I'm noticing even students in a film major get to college without having seen, it's possible that a film student can get to their college age and never seen a Hitchcock film or a Marx Brothers film or any number of films that we just kind of assumed was in the basic canon back in the olden days.
So are there any celebrities or TV shows of the past that still particularly resonate with your students?
Well, there are a couple that I think, and not to everybody, but there are a few, and I Love Lucy is one of them. I think everybody at some point has been exposed to that show, and maybe not by sitting down and watching an entire episode, but the references that it gets elsewhere in the culture. The Twilight Zone, even if you haven't seen an entire episode, that music and the whole fact that we use the words Twilight Zone as an idiomatic phrase to represent a certain kind of feeling and all of the rest of it. But if I were to choose, if I were to say, is there any program over 20 years old or over 25 years old that I can automatically assume everybody has seen, I think The Simpsons would probably be the only one in that list.
Or Meet the Press.
Right. I would say there are not only a lot of students have never seen Meet the Press, even though it's been on television since 1948.
Right.
probably a lot of the faculty have never seen Meet the Press. So that's an interesting example, because even if you don't watch the Meet the Press on Sunday morning, you are exposed to what happened on Meet the Press in all of these 24-hour cable channels, which talk about what gets said on that show on the following Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday.
And I'm sure most people are not aware, like you mentioned, that it's coming up on its 70th anniversary. It's the longest-running network TV show extant.
Yeah, that show has been on for a long, long time. And prior to that, but it was it got canceled several years ago, The Guiding Light was on the air for 72 years. It was on radio for 15 years, from 1937, I think, to 1952. So that's, what, 15 years. It was already an old show during its radio era. And then it went jumped to television and went from 1952 right into the 21st century. 72 years, one single story, arguably the longest story ever told. Well, I guess Gasoline Alley, a cartoon, a comic, went longer than that, but not as long temporally. And you know, that was really extraordinary. You had multiple generations on that show of characters, some of them played by the same people for half a century.
So in your classes, what are the sorts of things that surprise your students the most?
Well, I think, especially with the older stuff, how much of it they really realize that they've been missing, that they really like. And some of it, I think, they get surprised at what was actually being done. They think of old television as being really old-fashioned, and a lot of it was. But, you know, when we show them episodes of All in the Family, for example, they're surprised at how timely and contemporary and at the same time funny it was, even though it was made over 30 years before they were born.
But if anyone disagrees with you, they're either thrown into jail or called a meathead, right?
That's right, because this is America, the land that I love.
Well, I love it too, Mr. Bunker, and it's because I do it, I protest when I think things are wrong.
And stand beside her.
And guide her.
The right to defend is the principle upon which this country was based.
With the light from above.
Listen to me. It's in the Bill of Rights.
From the mountains.
Why do you think we broke away from England
prairies,
to begin with, huh? Because we didn't agree
oceans,
with her. We demanded freedom.
Would fall.
Gee, it's guys like you. It's guys like you who don't
God
listen to reason.
Bless,
I mean, you're letting us in there. And you're totally
you
closed-minded.
Hold on.
You're prejudiced. You're prejudiced. You're prejudiced. Not anymore. I'm leaving.
America. Get away from me. My home, sweet home.
And then the most fun is to introduce them to something that they'd never heard of, that they really then go seek out. My favorite example of that is the work of Ernie Kovacs. This is a guy who did some unbelievably brilliant, funny stuff, died an untimely death in an auto accident when he was really hitting his stride in 1962. And when I throw some of that stuff on, there's always seven or eight students in the class who it's as though they've, you know, seen a new light. And then, of course, they go to YouTube, which is a great opportunity because there's all kinds of that stuff that they can find if they are looking for it. And I guess part of a history of TV class is to guide you to the kinds of things you might want to be looking for.
I'm angry. Somebody flipped a brown martini in on me here. I have received here a short communication from a student who said, "We have been studying history. We are studying the stories of Mr. Americus Vespucci and Mr. Christopher Columbus and how they discovered the world was round. Would you please explain how they did discover it was round? Actually, it's not round at all. People are dropping off all the time." That is tasty, isn't it? Oh, I pity the abstainer.
Well, speaking of TV, at one time the term TV had a singular meaning. Now television can mean many things. So what does it mean to you now?
Yeah, well, I'm still of the opinion that if television, if something has sound and moving pictures, and you watch it on a frame, on a screen, and you're able to do it somewhere other than a theater, that's television. So I have no problem calling an episode of The Big Bang Theory television, which of course is old school TV, but I also call what Netflix is doing and what Amazon Prime is doing television, and I call viral videos on YouTube television as well, even though we tend to watch it on a different device. And it's amazing how much television, all these technologies have changed, but how much has really stayed the same. So when cable came along, that was just changing the delivery system. Instead of getting it over the air, we got it over a coaxial cable. But most of the same kinds of programming and a lot of early cable was reruns of old network shows. Then the internet came along, and for a while, it was something completely different. A lot of the first video people watched on the internet were viewer-generated, these kinds of viral videos that became so well-known, David After Dentist and Charlie Bit My Finger and Leave Britney Alone and Sneezing Panda. And then the advertisers got into it with these short-form, brand-based kind of programming. BMW with that famous set of films they got big filmmakers to do. But once things settled down, when we look at where the exciting internet video is happening now, Netflix, Hulu, Amazon Prime, all doing original programming, much of it very, very good. In so many ways, that is such old-fashioned television. Most Netflix shows are either an hour long or a half hour long, right. Same way as it's always been, even though they could be any length that they wanted to. They don't have the time constraints that broadcast TV did. And most of them, in one way or another, are in the old genres that we've seen before. House of Cards is a Washington intrigue story, and Transparent is a single camera comedy. I mean, it's interesting how now that internet video has really kind of settled into a set of traditions, an awful lot of the programming, even though the content has more sex and swearing and all that kind of thing, are in the forms that have been going on since television began back in the 40s.
When you were growing up, what was your experience with television, and how much influence did it have on you?
Well, I was not, and most people think because I went on to do this for a living that I must have watched television constantly. I didn't watch a lot of television, though I suspect I watched about the same amount as a lot of people of my age. But it was important to me. A lot of the things I learned about a lot of things came from television. Everything I know to this day about the mating habits of marsupials, I got watching some PBS documentary. Also, I remember some of the happiest moments with my family when my brother and I were both teenagers, and you're in that, you know, period where you don't really have anything to say to your family. It's uncomfortable sometimes even being in the same room with them. I grew up in the Midwest, and primetime ended at 10. And one of the channels would have reruns of an old Groucho Marx game show, You Bet Your Life, reruns of some other program. And we would sit there and watch that. And for a half hour every night, all could feel comfortable together because something else was happening. We didn't have to talk to each other. And it was really a kind of binding situation. And then there were other things as well. I remember, and this gets to something that would never happen today because I'd have a million choices. I remember watching TV, and it was on the weekend, and there was nothing else on. And the Olympics were on ABC, so I watched them because there was nothing else to watch. I wasn't that interested. I didn't care that much. I would have rather seen something else, but they were on. And over that weekend, they were doing a lot of track and field, sprints and shot put and high jump. And I was someone who had never been that athletic, never been interested in sports. I really got into track and field. That following fall, I joined the cross-country team. I started doing high jumping. That, because I was forced to watch something that I had no interest in watching, a whole new element of my life was opened up by that. I was introduced to something that I normally wouldn't have chosen to watch. And nobody really has to do that anymore. If you feel one way about one thing, you watch one 24-hour news cable channel. If you're interested in something else, there's other things for you to watch. And I think we've lost something in the fact that television no longer brings us all to this kind of common middle that sometimes introduces us to things we otherwise wouldn't be introduced to. That's the bad news. The good news is there are a lot more voices on television that were completely silenced back in the broadcast era.
We're going to have to take a little break from our fascinating journey, but never fear. I'll be back in a lightning flash with Professor Robert J. Thompson, who is traveling with us on the TV Time Machine.
This is Ned Brooks inviting you to Meet the Press. Our guest today is Senator John Kennedy, the Democratic nominee for president. Asking the questions today on Meet the Press are Edward Folliard of the Washington Post, Ellie Abel of the Detroit News, John Chancellor of NBC News, and Lawrence E. Spivak, our regular member of the Meet the Press panel.
Meet the Press, America's press conference of the year, and winner of every major award in its field, will continue after the following message.
We're back again with Professor Robert J. Thompson right here on the TV Time Machine. So what do you miss most about the way television was back then?
I suppose the thing I miss most about ye olden days of television was the fact that it was the one thing that everybody could talk about, because you could assume that everybody had seen most everything, at least at some point during its run. You know, if you were a young person and you wanted to see the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, you had to sit through the comic stylings of Mitzi Gaynor that your parents wanted to see, and vice versa. And there was a time when we all knew the same theme songs. We all basically knew the same characters. And those became ways in which we could talk to each other. If you said somebody was acting so Jan Brady, we all knew what that meant. It was a language of sorts. That is not the case now. Even with big hit programs like The Walking Dead or whatever, you cannot make the assumption that everybody has seen this stuff. The percentage of the population that knows a shared culture is much, much lower than it was once upon a time. I mean, there are cable shows that are happy with 3 million viewers. That constitutes something of a hit. There are over 300 million people in the country. That's less than 1%.
Right. The only time really we have the opportunity for that old-fashioned communal experience would be the Super Bowl, maybe secondarily the Oscars. Beyond that, there's not much.
Right, and that I say that's a very good point. One of the reasons why the Super Bowl is so valuable to advertisers, one of the reasons that they sell these ads for millions of dollars per 30 seconds, is that there are so few places where you can get the entire nation looking at one thing. And interestingly enough, even though everything else in television, the ratings compared to the pre-cable and pre-internet era, have gone down, the Super Bowl ratings have not only not gone down since these new technologies, they've gone up. Top-rated Super Bowls ever, top-rated programs ever, are at least two or three Super Bowls from the last five or six years. So that really is it becomes so valuable because it happens so frequently. Now, that isn't to say that every now and again. Remember in 1999 when Who Wants to Be a Millionaire first came out, and they were playing them night after one night after another, seven nights in a row. You couldn't go anywhere without hearing someone say, is that your final answer? When Survivor first came out in the summer of 2000, everybody was saying they're going to vote you off the island. So every now and again, we still get something besides the Super Bowl that penetrates the entire culture and becomes part of the conversation that even draws in people that may not actually watch the show. But it happens a lot less frequently. The number of catchphrases from 1970s TV that everybody back there knew, there are a lot more of them than there are catchphrases today. Well, I guess a lot of shows don't do that kind of thing anymore, but I think you know what I'm getting at.
Now, television back in the 50s primarily was live. Now, we're kind of going back to that, but via a different technology in terms of social media. A lot of communication is live via Periscope, via Facebook Live. Now, of course, the networks, they've been flagging in recent years. Do you think if they go back to a more of an emphasis on live broadcasting, do you think that might be their saving grace?
Well, I think live broadcast, and at sports, obviously, has got to be live. But I think live broadcasting, besides sports, is going to always be kind of a specialty type of programming. Now, you're right. NBC has had some great success bringing back the big ticket musical. And they've done that now, four Decembers in a row now. And those have, some have done better than others, but those have gotten a lot of attention. And the idea that doing something live might bring people to watching it all together and then tweeting about it and all that. And I think we're going to see that continue, these big live event sorts of things. Matter of fact, a perfect example of that is going to start in the last four episodes of Saturday Night Live, where for the first time ever, Saturday Night Live is going to play live in New York, and it's going to be aired live across the country in all time zones. So the usual way they do it, the way they've always done it, is it airs live at 11:30 in Eastern time zone and 10:30 in Central, but then it airs delayed at 11:30 and 10:30 for Mountain and Pacific. Now they're going to do four episodes where it airs live for everybody. So if you're in the Pacific time zone, you're going to be seeing it at 8:30. That's getting a lot of attention. I think people will like that because they're so excited about what Saturday Night Live's doing, and half the country wants to be able to see it when everybody else is. And again, there's the whole social media dimension to that. But back in the 40s and 1950s, where most television was in fact live, which was kind of technologically determined, I don't for a minute think we are going to get back to that kind of percentage of live programming, because for all of its excitement, it's got a lot of real disadvantages.
True, it has disadvantages. At the same time, it has advantages. In the case of the Oscars, that was a disadvantage and an advantage, a huge advantage, because that moment went viral.
Right, and I think we are going to see I think we're going to see more live television in the future, and we're seeing more now, certainly than we did 10 years ago when there was very very little of it. But you know, it is interesting. Even the shows that we could do live, like the, at least on in the Eastern and Central time zones, the late night comedies, for example, most of those are done live to tape several hours before it happens. And then on a big night like election night or something, then someone like Colbert will go live. The other thing is that one of the things about live TV, with the exception of sports, which is a different thing entirely, but is the risk that something is going to happen, some big disaster. And of course, that the Oscars this past time is a perfect example of that, where this just extraordinary collapse of what was supposed to happen happens. And that was really exciting to watch. I mean, one was uncomfortable for the people involved, but you really felt like you were, that was big action. That was more excitement I'd seen in the Oscars in a long, long time, maybe ever.
And the Academy Award for Best Picture.
You're impossible. There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
Moonlight won.
Come on, this is not a joke.
This is not a joke. I'm afraid they read the wrong thing.
Moonlight, Best Picture.
But for the most part, that doesn't happen. There's a level of professionalism in these big things that we've watched all of the NBC live musicals, and no lights fell from the ceiling. Nobody in any significant way forgot their lines. This is very cynical, but if I were a producer of one of those things, I think I would deliberately build in a couple of mistakes simply because part of the fun of live TV is to be reminded that it's live, that anything could happen. And surprisingly, a lot of this live TV stuff goes off completely as planned, and doesn't have the excitement of the that you know we've all heard about in the old live TV days when, what was it, that famous refrigerator ad where she was supposed to the model was supposed to display the inside of the refrigerator and she couldn't get it open.
Right.
And the whole point of that refrigerator was how easy it was to open.
It's such a messy job, and so unnecessary, too, when you own this wonderful new Westinghouse refrigerator. It always keeps itself frost-free. Yes. Somebody's playing games. Well, ordinarily, it's completely automatic. There's never anything that you have to do. And the secret is inside here. Yes. I think you've left off the current. At any rate, inside, there is a magic counter button, and it's the sign of the frost-free system.
We're going to have to take a little break from our fascinating journey, but never fear. I'll be back in a lightning flash with Professor Robert J. Thompson, who is traveling with us on the TV Time Machine.
In the 21st century, it may be that no home will be complete without a computerized communications console.
And this is a mock-up of the TV console of the future. This would go by your armchair and give you built-in hi-fi stereo record player with the stereo speakers here. And here you could put film cassettes in to play on your television set, get your favorite old programs. And the television set itself, we can expect the screen to get bigger, but the set to get much slimmer. In fact, it's sometimes said now that it might be possible to make the television set so slim that it could be hung on the wall.
Marvelous.
We're back again with Professor Robert J. Thompson right here on the TV Time Machine. Now, you talked about, of course, the nostalgia you had for the television of your youth. What do you think this generation will be nostalgic about in terms of television in the future?
Well, every generation, of course, and I think it's what you were watching between, I think the real kind of golden period is the stuff you watched between like age 5 and maybe age 15 or so. And I always know how to get a response from students by making a reference to something. You simply do the math. You think of, so for a while, if I made a Full House reference, you didn't even have to make a joke. You'd get a big laugh by simply saying the name of one of the characters. And that, of course, changes on a regular basis. One of those things that I think is still prevails to some extent is the programming on Nickelodeon and the Disney Channel. In that those early programs, in a lot of cases, kids are watching because their parents somehow think that those are safe channels, and they put their kids in front of it and they turn on the TV. So what you watched as a young kid on those shows, I think, will always be things that you remember nostalgically. But kids are now earlier and earlier controlling their own programming, and most of that is by what they're watching on their portable devices. And I think it is getting harder and harder to come up with single titles that you can get an entire generation to respond to. But everybody doesn't have to do it. I think we are going to be nostalgic 30 years from now to this incredible period of being able to binge watch one incredible show after another. I mean, we are now, whatever you say about the golden age of television of the 50s or the renaissance of television in the 80s into the 90s, for sheer quantity, when you look at the period between The Sopranos in 1999 and then The Wire and Breaking Bad and Mad Men and Fargo and just one show after another, this is an extraordinarily rich period. And maybe people are going to just kind of keep discovering that stuff as they get of an age to watch it, less than identifying it with the period in which it was made the first time around. Kind of more like books. Now that you can actually have libraries of TV now on your computer, but before that on DVDs, there's always going to be, kids are always going to be nostalgic for when they first read, for example, the Harry Potter books. It's not going to matter whether they read them as they were coming out or whether it's a 9-year-old that's just discovering them now. I think people are going to continue to discover and read those things at certain points in their lives. And my guess that's going to happen with a lot of what we can, for the first time, I think, use the word classic to describe some of these television shows that have come out in the last 15 years or so, that I think people are going to continue to go to like they go to old books, and not because it's what's on that they stumble upon in reruns, but because they've heard people talk about these shows and they want to experience them.
Well, speaking of experiencing them, in terms of television and technology, where are we headed? Are we headed for virtual reality? Or are we headed for implants? What do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, well, boy, if we're trying to predict the future too far ahead, and by too far ahead in terms of technology, that's like 5 years, who knows? I mean, we may have TV sets, beam directly into our cerebral cortexes, or they may come to us on the backs of rainbow-colored unicorns. I mean, who knows? Stuff is moving really, really quickly. I think a couple of things that we can assume, and that is that the old model of over-the-air stations, even though they remain important because they're the only places that still do a lot of local sorts of things, I think we can assume that more and more delivery of this material is going to be through some version of what we now have as online technology. I think the idea of having lots of choices that people then watch when they want to is clearly already here, and I don't see that going away. So if I were the owner of a station, I would be worried about my long-term future. If I were an owner even of a cable operation, I would not know where we were going to be. If I were the owner of any of these things, the one job, I think, in this entertainment television industry that is secure is that if you can write a really good story, a really good series about characters that people want to watch, you don't care how this technology goes, because that, in the end, is why all this technology exists in terms of television, which is it's all really about delivery. And I don't know in the future whether we're going to see, we may look back to this time as a real bounty of programs. I don't know if 20 years from now if we're going to have quite as many, just one right after the other, knockdown, drag out, great series of really high quality. And there have been a lot of them. Since the time we started this conversation, Netflix has probably released three series, two of which are probably pretty good.
Right. Yeah, and also we're kind of in a strange situation in that in many respects we've gone back to the small screen that existed in the 1950s when people watched a 10-inch television screen. But on the other hand, you have the other extreme where people are watching television on 40 and 50 and 60 inch screen television
yeah,
sets.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. There were two revolutions that happened simultaneously. There was the revolution of portability, thanks to the internet, which meant that television started shrinking down to a screen, you're right, the size of what they were back in the 40s when they first started coming out. But the other revolution that happened at the same time was these giant screens. And you're right. When I first got my 50-inch screen in 2006, I thought I was so cool. 50-inch, this is enormous. 50 inches now, been there, done that for right. A lot of people. So, and the other thing that took a while was how to merge the portable device, the online device, to the big screen, which is now something that many people are able to do. So you do have that option. If you want to catch up on Game of Thrones while you're waiting for your car to be repaired, you watch it on your tablet. Right. If you are home and you're watching an episode, you simply let it communicate with your big screen and you watch it on that. I think, obviously, that the watching it on the bigger screen allows you to see things that you wouldn't on the smaller. But I have many, many students who watch on nothing but their portable devices and seem to be appreciating and getting as much out of it as I do on my big one.
Well, Professor, it's been a tremendous pleasure having you aboard the TV Time Machine. Feel free to join us again in the future or in the past.
I'm honored to have taken a ride in it. Thank you.
This is Jim Benson. Join us again next time as our magical transport takes us on yet another journey exploring television's past, present, and future. You'll find your next adventure right here on the TV Time Machine.
I was born Mary Tyler Moore.
It's Jesse Donald Knotts.
Fred McFeely Rogers.
Leslie Moonves.
Isabel Sanford.
Leslie Renee Stahl.
Robert Edward Turner.
Regis Francis Philbin.
Aaron Spelling.
Since 1999, the Archive of American Television has been preserving the memories, knowledge, and insights of the men and women whose talents and vision have helped shape this remarkable medium. Over 500 video interviews with these TV legends are now available on the Archive of American Television website at metvlegends.org. There you can sign up to receive news, updates, and also become a sponsor to help preserve television history for generations to come. That's metvlegends.org.
The mythological proportions of Star Trek provide something that's missing in people's consciousness, psyche.
The Archive of American Television. Capturing television history, one voice at a time.